The military determined that it needs a certain capability overseas, and in this case, it was the Alaska Air National Guard's turn to provide that.
Alaska Guard members deploy to the Middle East. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 23rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, slowing the pace of marketing Alaska LNG.
The commercial negotiations have not moved as expeditiously as we would have wished.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're looking for a career that will put you to work immediately without any educational debt, think about the apprenticeship program and learn to become a construction craft laborer. The construction industry requires hard work, provides great pay, and a bright future while building Alaska. Application deadline for the apprenticeship program is March 31st. Call to begin your debt-free career track today, 907-345-3853. This message sponsored by Alaska Laborers Training School.
More than 100 members of Alaska's Air National Guard are deploying to the Middle East this evening. According to John Callahan, Chief of Public Affairs for the Guard's 176th Wing, the majority are from the 144 Airlift Squadron and will be flying C-130s as part of what are called intra-theater operations.
Instead of ferrying materials around the globe in and out of the theater of operation, they'll be operating within the theater, taking supplies and personnel from point to point.
The Alaska units are joining with active duty troops and members of the Ohio National Guard in operations combating the so-called Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. Callahan says for security reasons, the Guard doesn't disclose the location of where airmen will be based and declined to provide specifics beyond the Middle East region. National Guard activations are set by rotation.
The military determined that it needs a certain capability overseas. And it looks at its units and determines who can provide that capacity or that capability. And in this case, it was the Alaska Air National Guard's turn to provide that.
The deployment is expected to last for 4 months. The Alaska Democratic Party wants to allow nonpartisan candidates to run on the Democratic ballot in primary elections, and the party has filed a legal challenge to a state law that restricts the primary ballot to members only. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, some Republicans allege the Democrats are trying to pull a fast one.
State Democratic Party Chair Casey Steinau says Democrats want to open their ballot to be more inclusive, to welcome candidates who don't want to wear labels.
This allows folks who are clearly aligned with us, that have our values, who don't necessarily want to be pigeonholed into one political party, which is where I think Alaskans are these days, and it allows them the ability to go ahead and compete for our support.
Last month, the party changed its rules and asked the state to allow any unaffiliated candidate to appear on the Democratic ballot as long as they aren't registered with a different party. According to legal opinions the party obtained, the new rule is covered by the constitutional right to freedom of association. Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, as head of the Division of Elections, rejected their request, citing a state law that says a candidate must be a party member to appear on that party's ballot. But Mallott says, from the opinions he's read, he thinks the Democrats are likely to win in court. And the lieutenant governor, a Democrat who won office arm-in-arm with independent candidate Bill Walker, says he thinks the party has the right idea.
I think that individuals in Alaska and everywhere in our system of democracy ought to be able to vote for the candidates that they might choose that are arrayed on a ballot.
But Mallott says a wide-open primary without rules could cause confusion. Regardless, he says he had to follow state statute and reject the party's request. So to open their ballot, the Democrats will have to win in court. The Republican Party of Alaska has no official position yet on what the Democrats are trying to do. But Suzanne Downing, the Republicans' communication director, says she's talked to other people in her party, and they believe the Democrats are trying to destroy the party system in Alaska.
Because they can't seem to win elections under their own flag, so they are trying to move into a situation where they sort of deceive voters into thinking that independents are truly independent when they're actually being supported by the Democratic Party.
Downing says the election of Governor Walker and Malott was part of the strategy. Another sign of it, Downing says, is Margaret Stock, who is running for U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's seat as an independent, but she's hired a staffer fresh off Democrat Martin O'Malley's presidential campaign.
It seems to us that they're trying to run away from the Democratic brand because they haven't had success with it.
For the record, Stock says she's talked to both major parties. As an unaffiliated candidate, if Stock can't run in the Democratic primary, she'd have to gather signatures in a petition drive to appear on the November ballot. Steinau, the Democratic Party chair, says they're not trying to deceive or sneak secret Democrats into office.
I don't think that that's the case at all. I think it's actually the other way around. We're trying to make sure that we are as inclusive as possible and allow people to compete for our support. We're not asking them to run as Democrats. We're allowing them the opportunity to have the support of our party.
Juneau attorney Mark Choate filed the legal challenge in Superior Court late Monday. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Tomorrow is an important date in the state's long process of permitting commercial cannabis in Alaska. Marijuana Control Board Chair Bruce Schulte says Wednesday, February 24th, is the deadline for the state to have a permit application up and running.
From the standpoint of somebody who wants to go into the industry, February 24th is actually the starting point. It's not a deadline at all. It's really just the first date.
So for anyone expecting to buy cannabis products in stores, there are still many months to go before the start of legal sales. Though the state is required to start collecting applications, there are many regulations and rules that are not settled. For example, most local governments have not finalized their own laws for allowing prospective businesses. Schulte says he expects dozens of applications to be filed in the days ahead. Once an application is submitted, it kicks off an extensive vetting process of feedback from community councils, local governing bodies, and background checks of the applicant before going in front of the state's Marijuana Control Board for review in June. According to Schulte, commercial sales may begin by late August under the current timeline, but that's assuming municipal bodies like the Anchorage Assembly can iron out the rules that are fundamental to industry regulation.
There's still a lot of questions about what parts of town are open to this industry and what properties are going to be suitable. So I think a lot of people are just going to let the dust settle before they commit to a piece of property because there's a significant investment involved.
Schulte is himself one such applicant. A criteria for his position as an industry seat on the state's Marijuana Control Board is a commercial interest in the emerging business. But even he says that right now the emerging regulatory framework across the state makes investment a daunting prospect.
Being kind of a conservative guy that way, I'm waiting to see how all the planets are going to align before I commit to a piece of property and a specific application.
Schulte says state regulators are overwhelmed in advance of the deadline, and questions about applications are better directed to the Marijuana Control Board's website for now. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee plans to hear a bill that would levy a personal income tax on Alaskans. The income tax is one of several tax proposals from Governor Bill Walker intended to address the state's estimated $3.5 billion budget deficit. Others include higher taxes on motor fuel, fishing, mining, and tourism, as well as increases in alcohol and cigarette taxes. Walker is also proposing changes to Alaska's oil tax credit program. In its current form, the personal income tax would be 6% of your federal tax liability or the amount you pay in taxes to the federal government. If your liability is $5,000, you would pay $300 in state taxes. The measure is expected to generate about $200 million in new revenue for the state. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, getting creative to provide more space for education.
This was in the past. It's been, I think, a shop and woodworking area.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
State officials have put a number on how much they will trim from next year's budget for marketing liquefied natural gas from the proposed pipeline, $7 million. That's the cut Governor Bill Walker's administration will make to its budget request. It reduces the number of companies marketing gas to customers in Asia from 3 to 1. Deputy Natural Resources Commissioner Marty Rutherford told the House Finance Committee today the change reflects slow negotiations with the state's three pipeline partners, as well as the low price of gas.
The commercial negotiations have not moved as expeditiously as we would have wished. And recognizing the reality of the environment we all are living in.
The state originally asked for $35.7 million for the Alaska LNG project in the coming budget year. Now it's asking for $28.7 million. While negotiations are slow, the state still faces a tight window for completing the project. Between 7 and 9 years from now, many contracts in Asian countries will be up for renewal. Rutherford says some of these contracts won't be renewed because the current suppliers are tapped out.
And growth for LNG demand is fairly flat. It's not forecast to grow at a very strong rate over the next 10 years. So trying to respond to that market window, if you will, is a very critical issue for the state of Alaska.
Walker and leaders of ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips announced last week that they're exploring options to advance the pipeline. They say they'll provide more details next month. University of Alaska President Jim Johnson is touting a restructuring plan called Strategic Pathways as a way to save the state money. The plan, presented to the Board of Regents last week, would reorganize the system into three lead universities, but it lacks specifics about how much money it would save or which programs might be on the chopping block. Johnson told reporters today it's in the university's interest to withhold those details for now.
When we start naming particular programs, then people know exactly who's in those programs, and they start doing things like leaving. They start doing things like not enrolling next term, et cetera, et cetera. And so we end up with some very negative impacts in this uncertain situation.
Johnson also fielded questions about a proposal by Representative Tammy Wilson that would cut the university budget from $331 million in the governor's budget down to $288 million. Wilson told the House Finance Subcommittee last week her budget plan only contains money for what the university considers student instruction. It would eliminate funds for research and for outreach programs like the Marine Advisory Program.
I did hear from Representative Wilson today that the general fund support for intercollegiate athletics, which is about $8 million per year, is included within the 288. So that's a clarification I learned from her this morning. But outside of it is research and outreach.
Johnson is headed to Juneau this week to meet with lawmakers and defend his Strategic Pathways plan, which is meant to take shape over a 3-year period. He said a dramatic budget cut like Wilson's would force the process to go much more quickly and would make for a much leaner institution.
There will be much less choice in terms of academic majors for students. There will likely be less research that happens, meaning, of course, by consequence, much less outside revenue will be coming into the university. It'll be a lot more houses on the market for sale. It'll be a lot fewer people who are shopping at Fred Meyer's and buying your newspapers. It'll be a serious hit on our capacity to serve the state.
Johnson said the university has provided Wilson with extensive information about the types of research conducted at the university. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner is reporting Wilson has put the university budget on hold while she seeks a more detailed breakdown on how research is paid for and who benefits. The subcommittee had planned to finish its work on the university's budget today. The next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at 7 p.m. Competitive Iron Dog teams are starting to arrive in Nome today. Team number 8, Tyler Eckelstad of Palmer and Tyson Johnson of Eagle River, arrived at the 1,000-mile halfway point along the Iron Dog Trail just after 3:30 this afternoon. Team 8 won $10,000 for their effort. But they weren't the first team to arrive in Nome. The very first teams driving this year's Iron Dog Trail arrived more than 2 hours earlier, though with little fanfare. KNOM's Emily Russell was there when they came off the sea ice and down Nome's front street.
The crowd was tiny because Kent Smith and Frank Ferrer are part of the recreational class of racers. But there was one special person there to greet them.
And the mayor, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Good to see you. Good to see you. Welcome to Nome.
That's Nome Mayor Richard Benville. The rec class starts 2 days before the pro class. They usually arrive in Nome around the same time, but this is the finish line for the recreational racers. Frank Ferrer isn't new to Nome or the Iron Dog. He grew up in Kotzebue and raced in the pro class in 2012 and 2013. He wanted to race in the pro class again this year.
I had some issues. I was supposed to actually run Team 19, but me and the partner weren't getting along. So
Ferrer teamed up with Marquette, Michigan native Kent Smith in the rec class. Smith says the best part about the 1,000-mile trail is the people along the way.
Well, great people. Everybody's out there to say hello to us and meet us, and just great people.
Nome is the finish line for rec class racers, but it's only the halfway point for pro class racers. They have a long layover in Nome that includes a clocked repair session and a halfway banquet. They'll turn around and head for the finish line in Fairbanks Thursday morning. I'm Emily Russell in Nome.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Community Action on Toxics believes future generations have the right to clean water, clean air, and toxic-free food. Learn more by visiting akaction.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Community Action on Toxics.
Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Nanwalek School is nearing 150% capacity, but the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District has no plan to expand the facility. It's so crowded that next year the principal plans to move one class into a repurposed garage. Dasha Eaton with KBBI and Homer reports from the Alutiiq Sukpiak community of Nanwalek.
Principal Nancy Klein tours me through Nanwalek School, where somewhere between 75 and 85 students, depending on enrollment at any given time, are packed into a building that's supposed to hold 60. She points out the room that's the biggest problem.
This is our secondary science and math room.
The room is full with the current 21 middle school students, but over the coming years, Klein says, the class will become even more crowded next year and especially in 2 years due to an even larger projection of middle school students.
And this is the room that is going to be a little bit too small as the population grows for our kids. And right now it's plenty big for the kids that are in here, but you can see that when, you know, you put 30 kids in here, it would be fairly small.
And that's why Klein is repurposing a garage.
This was in the past, it's been, I think, a shop and woodworking area. We don't currently offer woodworking, so the district is going to purchase Connex, which will go out in the corner of the property out there, and all of this stuff that's in here will go into the Connex. And this room will get some flooring and be a room for kids to be able to learn in.
John Kvasnikov, the first chief of Nonwalik, says his people have been trying to get the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District to do something about their overcrowded school for a long time.
I know we've been overcrowded for years, and you know, it's like we've been asking what's going to happen, you know, and they've never really said anything to us. It's getting serious.
The school was built before statehood by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1958. There's been no expansion at the school since an addition in 1977. But the population of Nonwalik has continued to grow. A lot. According to census data, Nonwalik's population has nearly doubled since the state started keeping track in 1990. Kvasnikov, who has three children attending the school, says he believes the crowding is beginning to have a negative impact on students.
It's hurting our kids. They don't have no room for them. We've been saying that for years, and we've kind of been almost like out of sight, out of mind.
The remote community's concerns about crowding and requests for expansion were ignored by the district while they were flush with money, says Kvasnikov. Now that the problem is getting worse, there are no funds due to declining oil revenue. Residents are frustrated, he says, after years of sitting on the sidelines watching other schools around the region get fancy facility upgrades.
Look at Saldovia. They have way less kids than we have, and they got this nice school.
Julie Sisko, director of planning and operations for the district, says Kvasnikov is right.
What we need to do is build or add on to. But as you mentioned and everybody is aware of, there's no funding. And we're not allowed to bond, remember? The legislature took away our bonding for 5 years, if not more. So we don't really have a way to do anything.
According to the formula used by the State Department of Education, Sisko says the school is way over capacity.
By the square footage calculations, Nonwalik is 138% over capacity right now. The building is rated for 60 students. And the associated staff that goes with that. And we're, I think, just over 80. We're estimating it's going to be 150 this coming year.
Sisko notes that, in addition, the state formula does not include the high number of intensive needs students at the school, which often require an aide and additional space for learning activities. Kvasnikov says he believes Nonwalik will continue to grow.
Yeah, we could use a regular-sized gym and more classrooms. And, you know, they need more other stuff, not just classrooms. But, yeah, you know, keep our kids, you know, fit. And we want them to participate. We're growing and growing. We're going to keep growing.
And even though there's no money right now, he wants to see an expansion plan from the district so that the problem's addressed as soon as funds become available. In Nonwalik, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A lack of snow in interior Alaska helped the state's first wildfire of 2016 burn open tundra. The Alaska Division of Forestry says in a statement that the fire started and was extinguished Monday on military land about 10 miles south of Delta Junction. The agency says the fire was started by live fire training. Firefighters from the Fort Greely Fire Department extinguished the fire. Officials didn't know how many acres were burned and plan to travel to the site today to determine the size of the fire. The lack of snow cover and winds of 25 miles per hour helped the fire spread, and smoke was visible from Delta Junction. An independent southern southeast Alaska ferry system contributes about $50 million a year to the region's economy. The Inter-Island Ferry Authority just released a report showing its impacts on tourism, seafood, healthcare, and other industries. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Inter-Island Ferry Authority, known as the IFA, has been sailing for about 15 years. It runs between Hollis on Prince of Wales Island and Ketchikan, and it's separate from the much larger Alaska Marine Highway System.
We move people, we move vehicles, we move freight.
Dennis Watson of Craig is the IFA's general manager.
We take people to town to shop or for healthcare reasons or to vacation, or we bring tourists out to the island and bring them back to Ketchikan.
A new report funded by the IFA takes a look at what its approximately 50,000 passengers meant for the economy in 2015. Melani Shivens runs Rain Coast Data, a Juneau-based research firm hired to produce the document. She says fishermen and processors who depend on the IFA contributed about $11 million that year.
Businesses build their business models around having the IFA to transport fresh, high-valued seafood products, and fresh and live. There's gooey ducks, and there's oysters, and there's different product that without the IFA, these businesses wouldn't exist.
The report says last year's total economic impact for Prince of Wales Island was just under $20 million. The impact for Ketchikan was just over that amount. Shivan says islanders traveling to Ketchikan for medical care made up about a third of the spending.
I think because you have the IFA there, the medical facilities in Ketchikan are able to have more services and have services that are targeted at a larger population than just the Ketchikan population.
The ferry authority is owned by Prince of Wales Island Communities plus Wrangell. It pays for 85% of its costs through the fare box. The rest comes from the state and federal government, though state funding didn't come through this budget year. IFA's Watson says despite Alaska's tight budget, he hopes the legislature will resume chipping in.
I'm going to hand deliver a copy of this report to every office on the Hill. And they need to see it because, people that live around Fairbanks and places that don't have ferries and don't need marine transportation the way we do need to understand, what we're about.
The Ferry Authority owns two almost identical ships, the Prince of Wales and the Stikeen. That's because it used to have a northern route connecting Kaufman Cove to Wrangell and Petersburg. That shut down because it didn't attract enough traffic and lost too much money. But the IFA still has both ships. Watson says the authority looked into selling one to save money, but it decided it was crucial to have a backup. This is Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Emily Russell in Nome, and Daisha Eaton in Nunwalloc. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and Alaska's communities and in operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. At Alaska Pacific University, you will be inspired by the beauty of Alaska, motivated by devoted faculty, and surrounded by independent-minded, creative students pursuing their higher education goals. There's no time like the present to find out what they are all about. It's time to experience APU. Hashtag This Is Our Classroom. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.